welcome to the Emergency Quality Network Sepsis Wave 2 webinar series. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Jason Woods. Today, we're going to be discussing the new surviving sepsis guidelines and how they apply to our clinical care, as well as what they mean for national metrics and third-party payers. Our first speaker is Dr. Laura Evans, who was one of the guidelines co-chairs for the Surviving Sepsis campaign. Dr. Evans, before we dig into some of the details about this, are there any high-level points that you want to tell us about what the guidelines are or what they aren't, or any clarifications on what the goal of these guidelines was?
The new guidelines are not updated Surviving Sepsis campaign bundles. The sort of route by which the bundles are developed is that the guidelines inform the bundles, and the bundles are the responsibility of a quality improvement arm within the Surviving Sepsis campaign. So these don't actually reflect new bundles, I think, which has been a sort of frequently asked question. The second note I want to make, since this audience probably sees both adult and pediatric patients, is that with this revision of the Surviving Sepsis campaign guidelines, there's no longer a pediatric consideration subsection within the guidelines. Rather, there will be a freestanding pediatric Surviving Sepsis campaign guidelines, and those are currently in development. So then moving right into the meat of this, you can see this just was published in January, even though we called it the 2016 guidelines. These were presented last month at the Society of Critical Care Medicine Congress, and there were the participation of more than 50 subject matter experts, including Tiffany Osborne, who's also on this call, who was a representative from the American College of Emergency Physicians.
I know that one of the new things that's come up since the last time these guidelines were updated is the new sepsis 3 definitions, which gave a suggested alteration of the paradigm by which we consider sepsis as a clinical illness, as well as how we name the continuum. How did the Surviving Sepsis campaign choose to change or refine their terminology in light of these new definitions?
One of the early struggles that we had, or early issues that needed to be addressed during this guideline development process, was how do the sepsis 3 definitions fit in to this guideline revision? Many of you will remember in early 2016, a joint task force from the Society of Critical Care Medicine and the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine published new proposed definitions, or the so-called sepsis 3 definitions, with that sort of refined some of the previous definitions. And it changed the construct to define sepsis as a life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. So essentially said, sepsis is infection with a dysregulated host response that can be characterized by organ dysfunction. And then septic shock became a subset of sepsis with both circulatory as well as cellular and metabolic dysfunction that's associated with a higher risk of mortality than sepsis alone. So our guidelines panel had to have a lot of conversations about these new proposed definitions and decide how, if we do it all, how do we integrate these definitions into the guidelines revision? Essentially, when you think about it, the sepsis 3 definition of sepsis is very similar to the previous definition of severe sepsis. Previously, severe sepsis was infection with SIRS and infection-induced organ dysfunction. And now, sepsis is infection with a dysregulated host response characterized by organ dysfunction. So essentially, sepsis replaces severe sepsis. And that's the way we reflected the terminology in the new guidelines. So you'll notice the title and then all the references within the guidelines that used to say severe sepsis now say sepsis. What we didn't do was incorporate some of the suggested ways that these definitions might be operationalized. For example, QSOFA. And the reason that we didn't do that was these new criteria, the clinical criteria suggested for the operationalization, QSOFA, were not used in the studies that informed the recommendations in this revision. So we really couldn't make comment about whether the clinical criteria proposed in the new definitions could be used within the framework of this guideline.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the process that you used to develop these new guidelines, especially for those of us who've never sat on a guideline committee? I'm always interested in the inner workings of these panels.
The process was very rigorous and robust. It started with the development of PICO questions, literature searches of a minimum of 2 databases with assistance from professional librarians. Evidence profiles were generated for each of the PICO questions, and each recommendation was graded according to grade criteria, which I think many of you are familiar with. We then voted on the wording of recommendations and required 80% agreement to develop consensus, recognizing that consensus probably is never going to be achieved if we expect 100% agreement. And we did have recommendations that did not meet the 80% threshold. threshold and required reformulation and revoting up to 3 rounds. One element that's a little bit new to this particular guideline, to the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guideline, but not new to the guideline world in general, is the use of best practice statements. And best practice statements probably entered guideline methodology community a few years ago, and they represent strong but ungraded statements. So it's more than just expert opinion, because they have to use defined criteria to meet the criteria for a best practice statement. The best practice statement has to be clear and actionable. The message has to be necessary. There has to be clear net benefit or harm. The evidence has to be difficult to collect and summarize. So it has to be a question that's probably pretty hard to study. You have to have a very clear accompanying rationale.
And finally, something that I find interesting about these best practice statements is that they are not given a formal grade as compared to most of the other recommendations. Can you tell us a little bit about how we as clinicians should interpret the strength of a recommendation? What does it mean for us, for our patients, as well as policymakers?
A strong recommendation from the perspective of a clinician means that most individuals should receive the recommended course of action, whereas a weak recommendation or a suggestion, as we use in the PROS descriptions, different choices are likely to be appropriate for different patients, and that therapy should be tailored to the individual patient. Similarly, if you took that from the patient perspective, a strong recommendation, most patients would want that. A small proportion would not, whereas a weak recommendation, the majority of people would want that, but many probably wouldn't. And lastly, for policymakers, the implication of a strong recommendation is that the recommendation may be adapted as policy in most situations, including potentially use of performance indicators, which obviously is a big topic around sepsis, whereas a weak recommendation probably isn't appropriate for performance indicators, and policymaking around a weak recommendation will require a lot of debate and lots of stakeholder engagement. At the conclusion of this process and the effort of these 50-plus subject matter experts, including methodology experts, we ended up with 93 recommendations in this guideline. So it's like a very short, pleasant 60-page read. There are 32 strong recommendations. Again, using the phrase we recommend, there are 39 weak recommendations, 18 best practice statements. And then despite the whole literature review, the evidence profiles, there was insufficient data to make a recommendation about 4 PICO questions.
All right, let's get into the actual recommendations themselves. Can you walk us through some of the most important pieces to start?
Moving right into the meat of this, we start with a statement that recommends that hospitals and hospital systems have a performance improvement program for sepsis, including sepsis screening for acutely ill high-risk patients. Much like you all are participating in the Emergency Quality Network, we recommend that every hospital and healthcare system have some sort of performance improvement for sepsis, and that's a best practice statement. We know that performance improvements for sepsis are associated with improved patient outcomes, and in fact, a recent meta-analysis of 50 observational studies shows a big drop in the odds ratio of death when you do formally engage in sepsis performance improvement. In this case, it was an odds ratio of 0.66 from the summary of these 50 studies.
What about initial resuscitation? Do we have any additions or changes to the guidelines?
I think we're all familiar with the 2012 recommendation around initial resuscitation. Just to recapitulate that, we stated in the 2012 guidelines, we recommend the protocolized quantitative resuscitation of patients with sepsis-induced tissue hypoperfusion. During the first 6 hours of resuscitation, the goals of the resuscitation should include all of the following: the CVP goal, MAP goal, urine output goal, and the central venous oxygen saturation goal. Now, this is really nice because it's measurable and it's very specific. We recommended specific targets. We do have a lot of new data that inform changes to this recommendation, and we'll come back to that in a little bit.
Some of the most impactful work in this clinical area in the last several years are a number of trials that failed to show benefit of early goal-directed therapy versus usual care. What did you all do with that data, and how did that impact the guidelines?
Some of the new data that informed this from a meta-analysis that was published in Intensive Care Medicine in 2015 that looks at the Rivers trial, looks at the Jones trial, and then Process, Arise, and Promise as well, with the overall point estimate favoring neither early goal-directed therapy nor favoring control. So again, no significant signal of either benefit or harm to using the early goal-directed therapy protocol over the control. When you drill down and look at these studies, sepsis care has clearly changed over time. When we were looking at this as a guidelines panel, it's very clear, I think, to everybody that the overall management of sepsis has changed. In all three of the new studies, Process, Arise, and Promise, that were well-designed, large, randomized trials to address the question of the early goal-directed therapy protocol versus usual care. Usual care in all of these studies, patients had early antibiotic therapy and received approximately 30 mL per kilo of IV fluid prior to being randomized.
Okay, so great. What you're telling us is that we've all learned everything that we need to know about sepsis, and we don't need early goal-directed therapy or specific guidelines anymore because we're all already doing all of the right things at all the time. I'm just kidding here. I doubt that that's true, and I know that that's not what you're saying. So clearly there are some caveats anytime anybody's discussing using or not using a specific protocolized bundle in sepsis care. Can you talk about some of the caveats that we need to be aware of when interpreting these new guidelines?
We wanted to put this sort of caveat out there to say we need to be careful, though, about interpreting these results in areas where this may not be the case. And as much as we'd like to think that in all of our healthcare sites and in all of our healthcare settings across the globe, that patients are being identified early and they're getting early appropriate antibiotic therapy and early appropriate fluid resuscitation, that may not be the case. And I think that's one of the reasons why this Emergency Quality Network effort is so important. I think it became very popular to critique the work by Rivers, but it really was a game changer. It provided a construct on how to understand resuscitation, to start early, give antibiotics, to correct hypovolemia, to restore perfusion pressures, and in some cases do more, although what that more looks like now has gotten less clear in the new revision of the guidelines than in the previous iteration of the guidelines. However, these basic concepts are as important today as they ever were. So to sum that up, we developed this best practice statement that may seem intuitive to everybody on this call, but it really emphasizes the time sensitivity of recognizing and treating sepsis and septic shock, and that sepsis and septic shock are medical emergencies, and we recommend that treatment and resuscitation begin immediately. We also recommend that cultures be done prior to starting antimicrobial therapy in patients with sepsis and septic shock if it results in no substantial delay in this beginning of antimicrobials. We did not define what a substantial delay is. Obviously, there's no trials to tell us what that is. In the previous iteration of the guidelines, an example of 45 minutes was provided on the thought that 45 minutes, you could still get the cultures and meet your hour time goal for receiving antibiotic therapy. But because there's no evidence base to support that, we removed the specific time reference from the statement in this guidelines. We recommend that IV antibiotics be given as soon as possible after recognition and within an hour. And this represents a minor change compared to previous in that the quality of evidence for sepsis is now improved to moderate quality of evidence when it was previously a low quality of evidence statement. So now it's a strong recommendation with moderate quality of evidence for both sepsis and septic shock. The second bullet point here, we recommend empiric broad spectrum therapy with one or more antimicrobials to cover all likely pathogens remains a strong recommendation based on moderate quality of evidence. That's unchanged from 2012 to 2016. We streamlined some of the wording around source control, but the gist of it is still the same, is that we recommend that you look for a source of infection that needs source control and that source control be achieved as soon as possible. Coming back to initial resuscitation, again, the wording has changed in the very minor ways. It's been essentially simplified wording, but the gist of it is exactly the same, that we recommend that resuscitation from sepsis-induced hypoperfusion at least 30 milliliters per kilogram of IV crystalloid be given within the first 3 hours, and that remains a strong recommendation based on low quality of evidence. The second bullet point is new, that we recommend that following initial fluid resuscitation, additional fluids be guided by frequent reassessment of hemodynamic status. And it's difficult as a guidelines panel to get more specific in what specifically you should do as that reassessment, because there are probably many ways to do that. So that is a move away from the specific targets of the 2012 guidelines and a better reflection of the current state of the literature. We continue to recommend crystalloids as the fluid of choice for initial resuscitation and subsequent intravascular volume replacement in patients with sepsis and septic shock. And that's the same, a strong recommendation based on moderate quality of evidence. And we use the same wording as before about using albumin in addition to crystalloids when patients require substantial amounts of crystalloid. That's a weak recommendation based on low quality of evidence, so a suggestion to consider that. We could not define substantial amounts of crystalloid. The trials that have studied albumin versus crystalloids have used a range of indications, so there's no clear preference for how to define substantial.
What about vasoactive medications? Do we have any clear answer on what the preferred first line is, as well as what we should use if it's not working?
We continue to recommend norepi as the first choice vasopressor. That's unchanged. And then we simplified the wording around what your second line vasopressor choice can be, and basically say we suggest adding either vasopressin or epi to norepinephrine when you need to raise the MAP to target. So using either vasopressin or epinephrine as your second choice vasopressor, or adding vasopressin if you want to decrease the norepinephrine dosage, if that's an important endpoint to you as a clinician. And both of those statements are weak recommendations based on low quality of evidence. If the shock isn't resolving quickly, we have a best practice statement to recommend further hemodynamic assessment, such as assessing cardiac function, to determine the type of shock if your clinical exam isn't clear. So that may be bedside echo, that may be other mechanisms of assessing cardiac function. We suggest that dynamic over static variables be used to predict fluid responsiveness where they are available. Again, unfortunately, there's insufficient data for us as a panel to recommend one dynamic technique over another dynamic technique. And in many places, these techniques may not be readily available, particularly when we're talking about international guidelines that hopefully are being applied across the world. We continue to say that lactate can help us guide our resuscitation. We suggest guiding resuscitation to normalize lactate in patients with elevated lactate levels as a marker of tissue hypoperfusion. And we don't define a specific rate of clearance. Again, these studies use different rates of clearance. But in patients who present with an elevated lactate or have an elevated lactate, targeting your resuscitation to get that lactate to normal is a weak recommendation based on low quality of evidence. Just to sum up in the last minute here, I think these are probably fundamentally not changed in terms of their take-home message from the previous guideline. Some of the wording has been streamlined and simplified, and obviously the specific targets around early goal-directed therapy have been removed. But the take-home message of that we have to screen patients for sepsis, we should use performance improvement tools to help us in our sepsis effort. We need to start resuscitation early with source control, IV fluids, and antibiotics. We need to reassess patients' volume status throughout the resuscitation period, and there are probably many mechanisms by which that can be done. And what we suggest that lactate normalization can be used in patients who present with an elevated lactate.
Thank you so much, Dr. Evans. It's always incredibly useful and educational to talk to somebody who actually sat in on the development of any new set of guidelines and hear from them the pros and cons, the strengths and the weaknesses. So we really appreciate you being here today. Our next presenter is Dr. Tiffany Osborne, who was the ASEP representative to the Surviving Sepsis Campaign. We're going to be discussing implementation of the Surviving Sepsis Guidelines at the bedside, as well as which of the definitions and classifications that are out there we should be using when tracking and submitting quality metrics. Dr. Osborne, before we get to my specific questions, is there anything that you would like to tell us about the ASEP endorsement of the Surviving Sepsis Guidelines? Can you walk us through some of the controversies about definitions and how you handled them as an ASEP representative?
One of the questions I get is, ASEP endorsed the SSC guidelines, but not the sepsis 3 definitions. And so if the guidelines use the sepsis 3 definitions, why did we endorse the guideline? And the question is, because there's a lot of things that they had and that they didn't have. And one of them is that they did not have QSOFA. They did also support the use of lactate measurement and treatment. And these are important components that we can get into. Remember, the established definition before the sepsis 3 definitions came out, the established definitions, which is what is being used by CMS, presumed or known infection plus SIRS, as we know before. And this was really what we used as a screening tool. We didn't treat all of these patients. We used this as a screening tool. Then with severe sepsis, we knew we had sepsis plus end organ dysfunction. And an important component here is that it included lactate measurement and treatment. And then again with septic shock, sepsis plus refractory hypotension, whether lactate was there or not, if they had refractory hypotension, they were considered to be in shock. And that's clinically what we understand when we're working at the bedside. Think about how that differs from sepsis 3. When you look at sepsis, now what sepsis 3 was talking about is you've got your infection and greater than or equal to 2 SOFA criteria, which basically means end organ dysfunction. So you're saying infection and end organ dysfunction, but that excluded lactate. Lactate was not part of that definition. So additionally, if someone had refractory hypotension, they were hypotensive, you gave them fluids, they were still hypotensive, but their lactate's normal, that meant they were severe sepsis, not shock. And with that, again, remember that severe sepsis was not a category. When we put that and look at septic shock, okay, remember with the CMS, we said, all right, that was sepsis plus refractory hypotension plus or minus lactate. With sepsis 3, are you on vasopressors and have an elevated lactate? So there were a number of issues associated with if this could be interpreted as lactate's only important if the patient was hypotensive. That was a problem clinically for the American College of Emergency Physicians based on our evaluation of the current data that was available.
So just to summarize here, it sounds like some of your concerns regarding the sepsis 3 definitions were that the way they are worded could be interpreted as meaning that lactate is not important unless a patient is hypotensive.
So now bring in the surviving sepsis guidelines. And I'm just going to highlight some of these issues. One is when we look at what sepsis is, they're basically saying severe sepsis equals sepsis. But this is the established definition of severe sepsis. This is lactate is included as a component of end organ dysfunction. And refractory hypotension is part of shock, which is different from what the sepsis 3 definition was. Severe sepsis, still not a category. And when you look at septic shock, this is the same as the established definition that CMS is using, meaning if they have a low blood pressure, you gave them fluid, they still have a low blood pressure, they're septic shock, and lactate plus or minus, it's included in there. Whereas in the sepsis 3 definition, they had to be on vasopressors and have an elevated lactate to be considered in shock.
So it's really not that dissonant for ASEP to endorse the SSC guidelines, but also express concerns about the sepsis 3 definitions, especially where it comes to where to include lactate and how to parse out cut points in the continuum of sepsis. As Dr. Evans said, this is clearly an area where we're going to need more research after the publication of the sepsis 3 guidelines to determine how and where that we can use them. The big issue here that you're discussing was the lack of agreement between the previous established definitions and the new ones, and where it would be appropriate to use those when considering national metrics. Can you discuss with us, when we're looking at it from an institutional standpoint, both which definitions we should be using when looking at metrics, as well as what definition should we be using when we are looking to place a diagnosis on the chart?
I'm going to suggest to you that you use the CMS definition, the established definition, and I'll give you some reasons as to why. First of all, if we're talking about national metrics, good doctor, good hospital, bad hospital, established national metrics should be based on the established definitions. So if you're going to have accountability associated with metrics, it should have the most data to support it as possible. And I believe that the established definitions at this point in time is what has them. With regard to definitions, I think CMS did the right thing by saying we're going with the established definitions rather than going with the sepsis 3, which was what was out there initially when all this information first started to come up. I think national metrics, highest level of support, established definitions. If there comes a point where we have more information that shows us something different, and that becomes well established, we can look at changing that.
So how do other organizations, particularly third-party payers, play into the debate about definitions?
So a lot of the national third-party organizations that are looking at whether or not we're providing value for the dollar that they're spending, or they're looking at value in general as we're comparing across hospitals and comparing across providers, one of the things that is most commonly used is mortality ratio. Observed deaths over expected deaths. Sepsis 3 says sepsis is sort of equal to severe sepsis. So if you're looking at a patient that the established definition says is severely septic, and you're calling them a septic patient, is the acuity of that patient higher or lower than the established definition? And it's higher because it's someone that you would typically call severe sepsis that you're now calling septic. Is the observed mortality of that patient higher or lower? In general, it's going to be higher. So you have a patient that was typically called severe sepsis. You're calling them septic. That patient's observed mortality is going to be higher than expected because you're being graded as though the patient is septic because that's what you've diagnosed them. That's the code you gave them. Now, for septic shock, there would be no change because the definition is the same. If you're using the sepsis 3 definition, if you're calling a patient septic, which would traditionally be called severe sepsis or septic shock, your observed mortality is going to be higher than the expected mortality, and your mortality ratio will be changed. It will look worse. And so what does that mean? It means that if you're using an alternate definition, similar care may actually appear to be worse. So you could be giving the same care as someone else, but because of what you're calling it and how national metrics are being looked at, you will look as though you're providing worse care than someone who is not using those definitions.
So most of our discussion today has centered around what to code or document in relation to how we will be evaluated across hospitals and across providers. I understand those are incredibly important issues, But as far as the new SSC guidelines are concerned, what impact do they have on our bedside clinical considerations?
So one of the things that Laura brought up was the initial resuscitation. And how are we going to apply this at the bedside? And when they say best practice statement, they're saying basically consider this to be common sense. So one, consider these patients emergent. Begin resuscitation immediately. Then we talk about the IV fluids, 30 cc per kilogram. And then after the fluids, reassess. And that they felt was common sense. Now, when we look at early goal-directed therapy, as Laura pointed out, based on PROMIS, PROCESS, and ARISE, early goal-directed therapy was no longer recommended. But that was no longer recommended with a caveat. And the caveat is that you and I are providing care that is equivalent to the usual care of PROMIS, PROCESS, and ARISE. What that means is, one, in all three trials, it's early identification. That means 1 to 1.5 hours from triage.
This is such a huge point, and I really want to emphasize it. One can only assume that the findings of PROCESS, PROMIS, and ARISE apply to you and your institution if your usual care is similar to the usual care in all of those trials. Besides early identification, what else do we need to assure we are doing in the usual manner?
Early IV fluids, how much? If you look at the 0 to 6 hour mark, that was between 2 to 3 liters, but actually it was an average of about 2 liters as well before randomization. Early antibiotics, 1 to 2 hours from identification. And remember here that people were identified 1 to 1.5 hours from triage. So you're talking about a 3 hour time frame. So this is very similar to what CMS is talking about from triage if you had 3 hours to antibiotics. Early lactate measurement. Again, this is important because if you look at PROCESS, PROMIS, and ARISE, 30 to 45% of those patients were identified from lactate alone, meaning that they were normotensive and their lactate was greater than or equal to 4. Now, I have a colleague who would say, we identified them, we watched them, we gave them a cup of tea, we did a few extra things. Well, it's because we identified them, though. We don't know what would happen to these patients if we didn't identify them. We may not have just been able to give them some fluids and a cup of tea. It's different. Additionally, when we're talking about fluid, SSC recommends 30 cc per kilogram. CMS recommends 30 cc per kilogram. If you had a 70 kilogram patient, that's around 2 liters or so, which is, you know, reasonable for a 70 kilogram patient. It's limited data on those who are obese. There's some emerging data on diastolic dysfunction and what patient populations in which that might be a concern. And as we get more data, it'll be reevaluated. But based on the information we have currently, this is the data that we're going on.
I do want to make a note, because you'll hear it sometimes when people are talking, that one of the abbreviations for the CMS core measures is SEP1, S-E-P-1. One of the issues that I have when discussing core measures is, what do you do when you have a patient who those protocols are not appropriate for, either at the beginning or when you start them, particularly with fluid resuscitation, and the patient proves to you that they really cannot handle repeated boluses very quickly? How do SSC and CMS core measures compare on an issue like that?
One other thing that the SEP1 has is, if you are uncomfortable, you can give the fluid a little slower. It doesn't all have to be within 3 hours after you give a bolus. As long as it's over 151 cc per hour and you have in the order to a total of 30 cc per kilogram, then that counts. Guidelines should be a counselor, not a jailer. So if there's something that you really feel strongly about one particular patient, then you have to do the best to take care of the patient. If you're also looking at how do I merge that with staying with the SEP1 guidelines, you still give the fluid, but if you're trying to test them, you can give a bolus, you can test, and then you can either say, I'm giving another bolus, or you can start them on a longer rate of fluid administration that's at a lower rate, but it's to the maximum of the 30 cc per kilogram.
Do you have any thoughts on hemodynamic assessment and whether there's any particular method that we should use over any other?
So one of the big elements for us was CVP. So one of the things that came out from this was that CVP alone to measure intravascular volume was not justified. We use dynamic over static when we're able to. And in the ED, what do we use? We use ultrasound. And we use other non-invasive techniques, NICOM, whatever we can that can give us information quickly. our target mean arterial pressure is still greater than or equal to 65. That hasn't changed. And now here's the other piece is normalizing lactate, which is consistent with CMS step one.
Let's touch on one of the issues that we had brought up a little bit earlier in our conversation and discuss lactate. How does lactate predict or not predict things like mortality, and how can we use it?
I just wanted to bring up something for you here. If you look at the SSC data, the previous data, if you had a patient who was normotensive with a lactate greater than or equal to 4, that mortality was around 29%. If you had someone who was hypotensive with a normal lactate, that mortality was, again, close to 30%. These were really not different.
In other words, if one doesn't pay attention to lactate and instead focuses only on those patients with hypotension, there is the possibility of missing a group with 30% mortality. Can you give us any idea of any specific recommendations regarding elevated lactate and clearance of lactate?
Some of the data that we've seen regarding lactate, it's almost a dose response curve. Any lactate elevation, the patient that's not corrected, the patient has a worse outcome. So it's sort of like if you leave, let's say that you went down to the cafeteria and you bought something and you left your wallet in the cafeteria, you may be heading back downstairs to get there, so you're headed in the right direction, but until you have that thing in your hand, you're not completely safe, right? So the bottom line is that as the lactate begins clearing, you're headed in the right direction, but until the lactate is normalized, you're not really safe.
The last issue that I want to point out here is that SSC does recommend getting blood cultures before antibiotics, but specifically says not to delay antibiotics. So the goal for antibiotics is still within 1 hour. For CMS, the time is 3 hours, and that's also what Process, Promise, and Arise had used. All right, Dr. Osborne, any take-home points or anything that you want to say as we wrap up this conversation?
When Rivers initially started this, whether you ultimately agreed with the results of that study or not, a couple of things that it did that was really important. One, it said what you do as emergency physicians makes a difference, and it's critically important. In the United States, 70% or so of septic patients come through the emergency department. So what you do is important. Two, it said what you do is not only important, but it's important to do it early, and that sepsis is a time-sensitive disease.
My last question for the day is, do you think there will ever be any exclusions in the future for the step one fluid criteria? Do you think we will ever be able to identify patients up front who aren't appropriate for the process and never get evaluated by these core measures?
I think in general that most of the CMS measures that we've dealt with in the past have had some exclusions. At this point in time, I think that from their standpoint, maybe it's hard for them to determine exactly what those exclusions should be. In the end, you're the one who's sitting at the bedside and you have to do what you think is in the best interest of the patient. I think the majority of the time, 2 to 3 liters of fluid probably won't be a problem. However, if you've given a bolus and the patient is telling you that they can't take more, then you don't give more. But you know, your institution should be collecting the reasons why you don't do it so that that can all be reported back to CMS. That's what we're doing here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Evans and Dr. Osborne, for being here with us today. I know I personally can't wait for the next set of bundles to come out, as well as the pediatric guidelines. This has been the Emergency Quality Network Sepsis Wave 2 webinar series. As always, I'm your host, Jason Woods. Thank you so much for listening with us today.